Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 86, titled The Bodhisattva's Way of Life, Part 2.
No, 11 starts a new thing. So that all that is just a deep analysis, and that 7 through 10 are really critical. They're really, really psychological, cognitive therapy 101, really excellent. Then from 11 through 21 is developing what is called the tolerant patience, if you use patience, or enduring tolerance, if you use tolerance. And meaning that's the no pain, no gain strategy. When something hurts you, harms you, you make an advantage out of it by saying, okay, I'm going to learn to bear this, and I'm that which does not kill me, does not destroy me, makes me stronger, sort of attitude. You know, which we do normally anyway. You know, like when you go train in the gym, when you do something that you don't really enjoy doing, but you do it to develop a skill or a knowledge or a strength, then you voluntarily, you know, do something that is a little unpleasant. You know, you strain to lift that weight. You strain to memorize that thing. You strain to stay awake and study for that test, whatever it might be. So you do something purposely to build up something. So that's called enduring tolerance or tolerant patience. Developing your tolerance. That's why I like tolerance. You know, like asceticism is like that. You know. And once you get used to something, then you can tolerate it. Then you can get used to something a little worse and tolerate it. So when something bad happens to you, you say, okay, I'll use this to be stronger. Then another time it won't bother me. You know, I'll develop. This is a way of developing myself. Thank you so much for stepping on my toe and me learning to control my angry impulse. And you're developing my strength of anger. They call it the shield of patience or the shield of tolerance. I'm developing the power of my shield of tolerance. They use the analogy of a shield in all Buddhist literature, like a warrior's shield. And they show that it's not what happens to you, it's your reaction to it that determines how much suffering it produces. And he gives examples like someone, they see their own blood become especially brave and steady, and someone, they see the blood of even another person, they faint and fall unconscious. These reactions come from the mind being either steady or timid. Therefore, I should disregard harms caused to me and not be affected by suffering. Even when the wise are suffering, their minds remain very lucid and undefiled. For when war is being waged against the disturbing conceptions, the addictions, he translates this word klesha as disturbing conception, which I don't think is very good. He translates it as this word, klesha, which comes from a Sanskrit verb, klish, which means to twist something, like to wring out water out of something you washed, and klish it. So klesha means something that twists your experience. So addiction is perfect. Addiction is the right word for it nowadays. But he uses this disturbing conceptions. Some people use negative emotions. I used to use, unfortunately, affliction. And negative, disturbing emotions is wrong because some do. He used what? Conceptions. Conceptions is better than emotions because it can include some sort of cognitive thing as well as an emotional thing. But there are different lists of addictions. Addictions and principal and subordinate addictions, there are 50 of them, and so on. So, but addiction is perfect because, like, anger is something that people like. They think at first it's great when, you know, at first it makes them feel that they're stronger. When they get frustrated in a situation where they feel pressed in the situation or blocked in the situation, then they feel bad because they feel weak, unable to do anything about it. And then if they lose their temper, they get strength and they can do something about it. So the anger appeals to them because they think it makes them stronger. And actually, and your martial artists will tell you, that if you get angry in your battle of Aikido or Jiu-Jitsu or Tai Chi Chuan or whatever it is, Karate, you'll be worn out in a short time, you'll be off balance, your opponent will dump you on the ground because the anger will make you clumsy, it will make you a burst of adrenaline that will wear you, that will then flood away from you and you'll feel weak, and it's very much not to be done. The martial artist has much greater power by never being angry at the opponent, and then letting the opponent get all riled up, and then letting them fall off balance, and then using their own force against them. So that's the story of that. So that's the first one. Then the second one, so up to verse 21, is this called tolerant patience. Then from 22 on, it's called realistic patience or realistic tolerance. And this is where it combines with some degree of analytic wisdom, where you see that, some things, bad things happen to you that harm you, and you don't get angry with the things. You see, jaundice, if you get jaundice, you don't get angry with whatever afflicted your liver, or some inanimate or virus or whatever it might be. You don't get angry with it, some pollution. You are unhappy that you're sick, but you're not angry with some chemical thing that caused your sickness. So why are you angry with human, with the animate creatures? They too are provoked by conditions. Sicknesses just arise, although they are not wished for. And your addictions also arise. And you become angry without intending to become angry. And anger itself is produced. So this is starting to analyze the causal processes of things. And there's a wonderful one where it says, and then they reject the idea of a self. The conditions that assemble together have no intention to produce anything, and neither does their product have the intention to be produced. So people don't intend to harm you. They're just themselves the creatures of their own anger and frustration and involuntary behavior. And they're just like robots, so you shouldn't be angry with them. And that's what realistic one is, where you analyze, because what we do is we project an intentionality into the enemy, and we think, I'm angry with them because they wanted to hurt me. But we don't realize that that wanting that they had is something that they, that just overtakes them, and they are not acting consciously in a way. They're just behaving like a robot. So they're no more to be angry at you're not angry at a fire when you burn yourself on it. You're angry at yourself maybe for sticking your hand there. But you know it's the nature of the fire to burn. So it's the nature of a person who is unself-controlled to get angry. And then when they're angry or they feel hate, they will hurt you. And that's just the way they are. And you don't, and getting angry to some presumed real self and real state of anger that, or harmfulness or malevolence that they are manifesting is unrealistic of you. And so this is very excellent way. Again, this is very much like the martial artist who sees the opponent simply as an energy process of muscles and perceptions, etc., moving toward them and making moves to hurt them. And they just see it, and they see where to intervene with that, where to draw it out over here and then flip it, etc. And they're staying very calm and staying completely aware of the process. And they're not thinking, there's a personality in there who's after me and I got to get them. And then getting all wound up themselves. So that goes on until, and it talks about how people behave crazily, how they really are crazy when they get angry. So when seeing an enemy or even a friend committing an improper action, by thinking that such things arise from conditions, I shall remain in a happy frame of mind. If things were brought into being by choice, then since no one wishes to suffer, suffering would not occur to any embodied creature. Through not being careful or mindful, what we call mindful nowadays, people even harm themselves with thorns and other things, those who flagellate themselves and things. And for the sake of obtaining women and the like, they become obsessed and deprive themselves of food. And there are some who injure themselves through the unmeritorious deeds of hanging themselves, leaping from cliffs, eating poison and unhealthy foods. People do all kinds of things. They even kill themselves when they're angry. How could they be expected not to cause harm to the bodies of other living beings? So it's sort of seeing the poor helplessness of people, how they completely don't know what they're doing and how they do all kinds of self-destructive things. And being angry and hurting you is among those self-destructive things. So you should be compassionate for them rather than angry, it says. It doesn't expect you to here. It's just mainly getting you to use this anger of realism, patience of realism or tolerance of realism, to overcome the reactive pattern of reacting with anger to being hurt by some foolish person. So now, then, finally, the third type, which is called the forgiving patience, or literally the patience or tolerance of non-retaliation, but I think we can call that forgiving. Forgiving, because forgiving means not to retaliate, to not seek revenge, which is the normal human habit. And so then, it starts at this really radical idea, 47, having been instigated by my own actions, those who caused me harm come into being. If by those actions they should fall into hell, then surely isn't it I who am destroying them? This is like, in other words, you walk into a room and somebody hits you, but you're at fault because you got in the way of where they could hit you. It's that extraordinary a method now, this one, the forgiving one. By dependence upon them, I purify me, and they're helping me by hurting me. Because since I'm practicing patience, you know, and I want the occasion to practice it, so I need the stimulation of someone hurting me, then I'm getting stronger and getting merit by not reacting angrily when they hurt me, but by hurting me, they are getting demerit, so I'm harming them karmically, revolutionarily, by doing that. So you see, in dependence upon them, I purify many evils by patiently accepting the harms that they cause me. But in dependence upon me, they will fall into hellish pain for a very long time. Verse 48. So 49, so since I am causing harm to them and they are benefiting me, why unruly mind? You know, Shantideva is always arguing with his egotistical mind, his own egotistical mind. So brilliant mode of teaching. Why unruly mind do you become angry in such a mistaken manner? If my mind has the noble quality of patience, I shall not go to hell or states of extreme suffering. Although I am protecting myself in this way, how will it be so for them? Nevertheless, should I return the harm? Because then his mind thinks, well, in that case, maybe I should hurt them, and then they can develop patience, and they'll be in great shape. They won't. They'll get merit. And he says, no. And nevertheless, should I return the harm, it will not protect them either. By doing so, my conduct will deteriorate, and hence this fortitude will be destroyed. Well, he says in another verse, I forget where, but see, they're not practicing patience. So if I hurt them, they're just going to get angry more and want to hurt me back. So in other words, just hurting someone doesn't necessarily produce the merit in the person. They have to be wanting to practice patience. So then, okay. So then this is very, very extreme. And basically, it comes to where, and this is why Shantideva and the Buddhists cannot be understood, their whole vision of life, if you don't realize that to them the future life is absolutely part of any prudential calculation of what is ethical, what is good, what is bad, etc., that they might have in the present time. It's just as present to them. So here he says, thus it is better that I die today than live a long but wicked life. For even if people like me should live a long time, there will always be the suffering of death. So in other words, he's sort of saying that, don't give me this, I'm getting angry because then I'll defend myself and I have to defend my body here or someone will hurt me. He says, no, if you're angry, then you have succumbed to your enemy. And that anger will cause you to have very bad future lives because you will cause harm to other beings through that anger. And it's much better that you die staying patient, because your patience will then cause your rebirth in a more beautiful way. And remember I told you in the effect of karma, one of the detailed things is beauty comes from patience, from tolerance. That's where beauty comes from. Ugliness comes from hatred in previous life, from being motivated by those things. Suppose someone should awaken from a dream in which he experienced 100 years of happiness. And suppose another should awaken from a dream in which he experienced just one moment of happiness. For both of these people who have awoken, that happiness will never return. Similarly, whether my life has been long or short, at the time of death, it will be finished like this. He's so clever, Shantideva. Though I may live happily for a long time through obtaining a great deal of material wealth by being aggressive and violent and vicious and dominating with people, I shall go forth empty-handed and destitute, just like having been robbed by a thief. In this case, death is the thief. And then, oh, but somebody says, no, but material wealth will enable me to live, and then I'll be able to consume evil, do good, his mind argues. Then he says, but if I'm angry on account of it, will not my merit be consumed and evil increase? Yes, it will. And what use will be the life of one who only commits evil? Because you're just making your life worse, actually, destroying yourself by committing evil. If for the sake of material gain, he causes the merits needed for life to degenerate. And so it goes on like that to a very deep level, basically, where he gets to where he makes it completely logical. And this is, of course, now, you know, the sort of calculus of karma. And this is where you have to remember that all theories about relative reality are relative. So in a way, with that caveat, Buddha is acknowledging beforehand, before he puts forth any theory, like a good scientist should acknowledge beforehand, if they follow the Popperian, you know, theory of science, that a law of nature or a result or a discovery, a fact, is a hypothesis, actually, awaiting falsification by future evidence, that so far is verified or supported by existing evidence, but in principle awaits falsification by other evidence, by counter evidence, or further evidence. So in other words, you can't get dogmatic about any supposed law of nature. It's Karl Popper's theory, which I think scientists sort of believe in, why the working quantum physicists discount a lot of the speculations of theoretical quantum physicists by saying that they are unverifiable or unfalsifiable by experiment because they're just too far out. And so, you know, multiple universes and all kinds of things that are irrational. But the Buddha is admitting that ahead of time. So he's acknowledging that his evolutionary theory, the theory of karma, is a kind of rationalization in a way. And therefore, they are useful in a certain context, but they're not, you can't say they're absolute dogmas and things just have to exactly happen this or that way. He's admitting that before giving a description, which is, you know, that's like your inconceivability. Your inconceivability is admitting that any theory about anything, including the theory of inconceivability itself, is subject to further interpretation. You know, if somehow some aspect could be conceivable, someone could figure out a way to do it. It's like when Carl Sagan asked the Dalai Lama on video, what would the Dalai Lama do if he had made a foolproof experiment disproving reincarnation? And the Dalai Lama said, to Sagan's sole astonishment and shock, he said, if you can make a foolproof experiment and disprove it, I'd stop believing in it. He said, this Dalai Lama is supposed to be a reincarnation, right? He said, I would quit believing it. So Sagan said, what? He's like agreeing to the evidence? Absolutely, he says. So then Dalai Lama waits a minute while Sagan tries to digest that. And then he says, now how would you go about making that experiment? Let's get to it. Let's get on it. And Sagan was silent. He couldn't think of course, an experiment. There is no such experiment. So on the opposite, there's the opposite kind of experiment that has been done, actually. So anyway, but I'm not going to... So the point is that he completely... Yeah, so when something terrible happens to you, in other words, the use of the karma theory, this is kind of an advanced practice, but it's here, is I'm at fault. I did something bad in a previous life. You yourself blame yourself as the victim. Mentally, which doesn't mean in a social setting you might still want to criticize the person who, or resist, etc., the person who did the bad deed to you. But in your mind, you say, well, this is my karma. I did something bad in the past, etc. So I will use this to improve myself not to do such a thing in the future. So you create a thing, you empower yourself by blaming yourself as a victim. This is a little bit tricky. You do. But it doesn't, and this gives you greater energy by not being sort of righteously indignant and angry about having been harmed. You're kind of cool. Oh, great, I'm going to use this to improve myself. And then you might, because it was bad for the person who did it, you might actually then pursue them, sue them, accuse them, expose them. It doesn't mean you, but you wouldn't do that in a way where you are all like freaking out. Because you'd be saying, well, gee whiz, you can help me out by hurting me. And I'm going to use this to become a greater person that will not be disturbable by anything, build a powerful shield, a nuclear-powered shield of patience. But you did nothing bad for you and for others, so I will oppose you, and I'll be totally cool opposing you. I'll oppose you with a smile. It's a very tricky thing and very cool. So and he gets into this here about this, and that's why it's considered such a great teaching, you know. And he will overcome, you see. Likewise, when the fire of hatred spreads to whatever my mind is attached, I should immediately get rid of it for my fear of my merit being burned. So in other words, in a conflict, and then he says, you know, you can kill enemies mile a minute and they just come back at you. But when you kill the enemy of hatred in your heart, then no one can really bother you, actually. You know, you're in an immune state. It doesn't mean you couldn't be killed even, but you would stay happy and be reborn well, you see. In his reality, you see, because he's swimming in a current of many lives, this man, in a specific way, not just because being many lives is good, but being many lives could be horrible if you go in a negative way. But being many lives and has been horrible infinitely in the past. But once you're floating on tolerance, floating on love and compassion, floating on the ability to absorb whatever without it disturbing you, and floating in a sea of beauty, you're then no problem. One body or another, they'll always be better. They'll be better and better. So, having generated the awakening mind through wishing all beings to be happy, why should I become angry if they find some happiness themselves? Oh dear. So finally he gets to that kind of extreme situation of where the only defeat that you can suffer is when you yourself become angry. That's the enemy, and if the enemy infiltrates your mind by having you be like the enemy, and then here, you know, yeah, 108, I'm not going to get to compassion this time, I have to do it next time, so anyway, let me finish with this. So on 107, 108, he says, therefore, just like treasure appearing in my house without any effort on my behalf to obtain it, I should be happy to have an enemy, for he assists me in my conduct of awakening. And because I am able to practice patience with him, he is worthy of being given this very first fruits of my patience, for in this way he's the cause of it. And then the mind argues and says, but why should my enemy be venerated if he has no intention for me to practice patience? And then the answer is, but why venerate the sacred Dharma, the teaching, for it too has no intention, but is a fit cause for practice. But surely my enemy is not to be venerated, for he intends to do me harm. And the answer, but how could patience be practiced if, like doctors, people always strove to do me good? Thus, since patient acceptance is produced in dependence upon one with a very hateful mind, an enemy, that person should be worthy of veneration just like the sacred Dharma because he is a cause of patience. So therefore, we shouldn't hate our enemies. Very, very good.